Okay, welcome everybody. This is the first office hours session for Econ. I think it's 400 is the actual level of the course. Mises is on money and banking, where we're basically going through selected portions of theory of money and credit. And this is the first office hours session. And for those who are watching the video, you can tell I'm coming from the gym. So that's why I don't look like I'm about to go to the Academy Awards right now. So, as we always do with these things, it's a free-for-all, so go ahead and, for those of you who are logged in live here, post whatever questions you have right in the chat box. Okay, Luis Enrique Ponce, I'm not even going to try to say your last name because I'll kill it, says, Dr. Murphy, what is your view on the Republican primary so far? Any chance to return to sound money in the near future? Incidentally, just in case there are people here who this is their first class, what I say is on these office hour sessions, go ahead and keep, if you have a question you want me to answer, just go ahead and type it in. So, like, in other words, don't wait for me to finish my answer to the current question, because then I don't know if there's pending questions. So, I mean, I can make my answers take longer or shorter. So if I see there's 8 questions that are on deck, I'll be brief, whereas if it looks like no one else has anything to say, I'll just keep droning on and on. So if you have questions for me to answer, go ahead and keep typing them in and hitting enter, and I'll get to them. Okay, Lewis. Well, for one thing, I haven't been watching the debate. I literally don't own a TV. I'll see stuff after a debate. People will put Ron Paul's answers on a YouTube clip or something, so I'll watch that. Or if there's some particularly funny thing that happened, I'll see clips of it, or I'll watch Jon Stewart a week later when I'm balancing my checkbook. I'll have that going on in the background, and I'll hear a lot of stuff that way. But I actually have not been watching the debates at all, and I don't even really follow. I tuned in to the first, Iowa and New Hampshire. I watched those just to see, you know, is Ron Paul, do they have a shot, that kind of stuff. But I haven't really been paying too much attention. Rob Paul keeps doing better than I thought he was going to do. So, I mean, that's good. Do I think he's going to win at this point? If I had to guess, I would say no, not because I think the country wouldn't support him, but just because I think the Republican establishment would come up with some way to cheat if it had to. You know what I mean? Like, I can't believe they would let him win. So I know I'm not supposed to say that because it sounds defeatist, and then people don't want to go out and volunteer and call potential voters and stuff like that. But, I don't publicly say that, but you asked me, so to answer your question, I don't think anytime soon we're going to go back to sound money. I think what has to happen is we have to educate more people. So I'm not completely fatalist or pessimistic, but I think you need a huge groundswell of public opinion for sound money for it to happen. And I think the Ron Paul campaign or phenomenon is a great vehicle to do that. So don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, oh, gee, he shouldn't have run for president because I don't think he's going to win. That's not what I'm saying. But my point is, if you're asking me, do I think we're going to have competing currencies 2 years from now, I think the only way that would happen is if there's an absolute financial crash. And, so I don't think there'd be an orderly where the people in Washington and Congress all vote on it and say, oh, yeah, let's have competing currencies. I don't think it would happen that way. I think if it did happen, it would be because there's absolute chaos and people just don't wait for Washington to give them permission and they just go do it on their own. If it were going to happen anytime soon. Let's see. Let me just say one last thing about the primaries. It just stuns me that because I just did, so you guys know my background. When I was in high school, at one point I called myself a conservative, and before I called myself a libertarian, and that was only as I got older in high school that I started reading Rothbard and stuff. But like when I was a freshman in high school, I listened to Rush Limbaugh and thought he was awesome. And, I think I subscribed to National Review, the magazine. So, I was the term, or I didn't know the term back then, I don't know if the term existed, but I mean, I arguably was a neoconservative back then, you know, and with a more purist free market bent than a lot of neoconservatives today. But I mean, I was a big fan of the first Gulf War invasion and stuff. So I mean, I think I kind of know this mindset, and it astounds me that right now the two apparent front runners are a guy who literally sat on a couch with Nancy Pelosi to talk about climate change, and another guy who had the precursor to Obamacare when he was governor of Massachusetts. I mean, it's how can it possibly be that those are the two people to represent conservative principles that, you know, the Republican primaries generate? That's just shocking. Like, what? And in the last cycle too, it was John McCain, who is the most, you know, wishy-washy, moderate, not, you know, no purist principle at all, even if you are a conservative in the way that term is used nowadays. So I'm not even saying whether you agree with the principles or not. I'm just saying if you actually listen to, like, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and you thought those guys were great, I can't believe they're rallying now around, you know, Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich. You'd think at some point even those people would say, something is really weird here. Like, we're not getting the politicians that we claim to want and that, you know, the intelligentsia, you know, our guys who are in the media and stuff want to represent. Or, you know, it just, I don't know. Anyway, I'm waiting for those types of people to start embracing third-party candidates or people outside the mainstream just because they're realizing this system doesn't work. Like, people just keep lying to us. The Republicans actually don't care about shrinking government. You know, I'm waiting. In other words, I can understand why if you're a big-time national security, you know, the Pentagon's a great kind of person, why you wouldn't support Ron Paul because you think, oh, we'd all get killed by terrorists. You know, Iran would nuke us. If you actually believe that, then you could see, well, I can't support Ron Paul, right? If that's what you actually, I mean, I think that person would be wrong, but suppose you actually believe that. Okay, but still, you're going to support Newt Gingrich? You're going to support Mitt Romney? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm just baffled by how these people can all rally around and say, oh, yeah, but we can't reelect Obama. Why not? If you're going to have somebody awful in the White House, have it be a Democrat who doesn't claim to be the free market candidate. I mean, it's very good, I think, that Obama won and not McCain, because their policies would have been virtually the same, but at least now we get to blame the economy on socialism, whereas if McCain had won, it would be the same economy, and people would say, oh, that's the free market for you, because McCain would have run as a free market guy. So that's what really astounds me, is that all these Republicans are going to go and get all whipped up and let's turn out the vote, so Obama doesn't get reelected, and then put in, you know, in their minds, McCain or Gingrich. That's insane. All right. Hang on, let me just check and make sure everything's all right. Okay. The lay, just so you guys know, the layout on the software on my end is a little bit different because they upgraded from the last time we had a class, so I'm a little bit fumbling around here. Okay, Chad Nelson says, I emailed John Tamney, editor of Real Clear Markets, to tell him that I liked a lot of his pieces and that he sounded like he was coming from an Austrian perspective. I asked him if he was a Rothbard fan, and his response was that he's a big Austrian fan, particularly a fan of Mises, but that he didn't agree with Rothbard on money. He said this about Mises. So apparently this is now Chad quoting John Tamney. He didn't, meaning Mises, didn't concern himself with supply of money. Rather, inflation to him was overissuance of the currency relative to demand, such that the currency price of gold rose based on that overissuance. The moderns, presumably meaning modern Austrians, and I would throw Rothbard into that mix, near as I can tell, view increase in the supply of money as inflation itself. I disagree. When we produce, we're demanding money, so a growing economy would naturally require more dollars. And then I think now it's back to Chad talking because there's not quotation marks. Chad, like, posting multiple things. So I think now Chad done quoting John, and is back to Chad talking. Does Mises see the need for increases in the money supply with an increase in population? This is something Rothbard clearly did not believe in. Okay, good. Let me adjust this camera. Good questions. So we're going to, I'll just touch on it a little bit today in the office hour session just to give you a little sampling, because this is, I think, I'm pretty sure we're going to formally cover this in the, you know, in the syllabus. So I think we're going to actually read these parts. If not, when we get to that section of the book, I'll try to remember to at least say something quick about it, you know, to say, hey, you weren't assigned this reading, but just so you know, this material's right here, because it's that we do hit this. You know, Mises does talk about this in Theory of Money and Credit, and that's where, more than any other place, you're going to get this view. So for those of you who don't even know what the issues are, what Chad, or rather what John Tamney, being quoted by Chad, was alluding to, is the definition of inflation. There is some controversy among Austrians about that. So Rothbard defines inflation in various places as an increase in the quantity of money that's not matched by an increase in specie. So if in a total free market, so there's a couple consequences from that, and specie meaning like hard money, like gold, commodity money. So there's a couple consequences from that definition. One is that in a totally free market where Rothbard believes you'd have 100% reserve banking. And for those of you who are new to this, if you don't know the terms I'm talking about, we'll explain all this as the semester goes on. So don't panic if you don't know what I'm talking about. But Rothbard thinks that fractional reserve banking is fraudulent, and so he doesn't think it would happen on a genuinely free market. So Rothbard thinks in a true free market you would have commodity money and 100% reserve banking. So since he defines inflation as an increase in the money supply that outstrips an increase in the quantity of the actual, you know, commodity-based money, if you will, then that means inflation can't even occur on a free market. Now, I don't know. I don't remember Rothbard ever saying literally in so many words, inflation is impossible on a free market. Okay? All I'm saying is the way he defined inflation and given his other views, that is a, you know, logical deduction. An implication of his other positions would be monetary inflation is impossible on a truly free market. All right? So like I said, don't. I think Rothbard would agree if I said, you believe that, right? I'm guessing he would say, yeah, but I'm just, you know, warning you guys, I don't know that he literally said it in so many words. I'm just talking about this is an implication of the way he defined inflation in a few spots. Whereas Mises, in Theory of Money and Credit, it's like I said, I'll try to remember to point this out when we get to that part in the book. He says inflation, if you're going to define inflation scientifically, the only definition that makes sense is to say it's an increase in the, does he say supply or does he say quantity? I don't remember the exact wording, and plus the translation, but he says something like it's an increase in the supply of money that outstrips the increase in the demand for money. So if you think about it, that means monetary inflation necessarily goes hand in hand with a fall in the purchasing power of money. Because right, if the supply of money increases more than the demand, that means the price of money drops. Just like if the supply of apples increases more than the demand for apples, the price of apples drops. So you do the same thing with money. So the price of money drops, but what's the price of money? It's the inverse of the, or it's purchasing power, or the inverse of it, right? So so if the price of money drops, it's not the inverse, it's the purchasing power directly. Then the purchasing power drops, meaning the price of money says how much stuff do you have to give up, how many real goods and services do you have to get up to obtain a unit of money. And so to say that that price goes down means that it's easier to get money. I am getting mixed up. It is the inverse, meaning that the purchasing power goes down, so you don't have to give up as much stuff. So prices, it's the inverse of the price level. That's what I was fumbling with there. All right, so if the price of money goes down, the prices of goods and services go up. So under that definition, the interesting implication is, oh, so if the demand for money goes up, the demand to hold money, and again, if you're not sure what these terms mean, we're going to define all this stuff. Like if you're fumbling and saying, what does it mean to say the demand for money? We'll talk about all that. But if the demand to hold money goes up, then Mises in that passage seems to be saying it would be okay to increase, even if the commercial banks do it, to increase the quantity of money, you know, maybe just by lending it out, you know, creating more money out of thin air by through fractional reserve banking. And as long as they didn't issue more than the increase in the demand, then that's not inflationary. And so, you know, maybe that won't set into motion the boom-bust cycle. So that's what the controversy is. There are modern Austrians that say, right, the only time you cause a boom-bust cycle is if you increase the quantity of money more than the demand increase. But as long as you're just matching the increase in demand, that's good, even if you're doing with fractional reserve banking. Whereas there's other Austrians in the Rothbardian line, like Joe Salerno, for example, who's going to say, no, I don't care what the demand for money is. If the demand for money goes up, great. And then if the banks issue fiduciary media, meaning money that's not backed by an increase in gold, then that will set in motion the boom bust cycle. In other words, Salerno, following Rothbard, is going to say the boom bust cycle occurs when the banks create money out of thin air, and you don't negate that problem by telling me, oh, but guess what? The banks did that during a period when the demand for money happened to be going up. So Salerno and Rothbard, I think, would say those are two independent things. I don't care what the demand for money is doing. If you create money out of thin air, that will make interest rates lower than they should be, and that screws things up. It gives false signals. So that's the issue, and it sounds like that's what this Tanya guy is getting at. And so, you know, I don't want to, when we get to that, we'll read Mises and talk about it more carefully. The thing, what's interesting is that if you go, well, we will, when we go and look at that later on in this course, when we get to that part of the book, it is true that Mises says that. You know, he does say if you're going to define inflation as an economist, that's the only term you can use that makes sense. But even there, it's a very reluctant definition that he's giving. And you can see in the context. And then he quickly goes on to say, but you know, in terms of the political arguing over the printing of more money and this kind of stuff, it's, you know, the economist shouldn't come in and start getting real nitpicky with the definitions of inflation and deflation. Okay, so it I'm probably reading too much into it because I'm biased and I agree with Rothbard and Salerno on it, but it's not like Mises comes out swinging for the fences for the free banker interpretation is what I'm getting at. It's like he's saying, okay, yeah, if you stick a gun to my head and you force me to give you a definition of inflation, this is what I would say, but you know, when you got partisans arguing over the proper course of monetary policy, you know, the great danger is the government's going to let too much money get printed. You know what I mean? So it's, I think today's free bankers who look at that and say, yep, see, Mises agrees with us and Rothbard's wrong. It's, like I say, Mises did say that. There's, you know, so we can't say he didn't say it. He did. But it's a lot more nuanced. Like I say, it's more, he's saying, if you had to come up with a definition, this is what it would be. but this is a very subtle thing. And then later, in other places, in Theory of Money and Credit, let alone, you know, when Mises is more mature in writing Human Action, later on in Theory of Money and Credit, he explicitly says, fraction reserve banking sows the seeds of its own destruction. And he doesn't say fractional reserve banking over and above an increase in the demand for money. He just says flat out fractional reserve banking. You know, he doesn't call it fractional reserve banking, whatever term he uses. But so it's my point is when we're trying to in the modern Austrian libertarian struggle over the issue of fractional reserve banking. In case you don't know, just to give you guys a little bit of a background, there are Austro-libertarians today. Some of them think that fractional reserve banking is fine as long as it's done by, you know, voluntary contracts in a free market. So nobody wants there to be a government central bank, obviously. But the issue is we have a free market in money and banking. Could these private banks engage in fractional reserve banking? So you come up, let's say gold is the money. You put in, you know, 1,000 kilograms of gold on deposit. Can the bank then go lend out half of that to somebody else, and you still think you've got that money in your checking account, and you can go write checks on it and stuff, and as long as there's not a bank run, the bank's fine, and it keeps doing that, is that fine, or is that fraud? And so Rothbard and Salerno say, oh, no, that's fraud, you can't do that, whereas people like Larry White and George Selgin and Steve Horowitz would say, no, that's perfectly fine. You use market forces, and we don't know what the reserve ratio would be, but it doesn't need to be 100%. So that's the dispute. And so then, obviously, if Austrians are going to argue about something, one of the things is to say, well, gee, what would Mises have said? And so that's the point, that the free bankers, that's the term of the people who think fractional reserve banking per se is okay. It's just that if, you know, the central bank does it, there's passages in Theory of Money and Credit that do seem to support their view, but the Rothbardians can point to other passages from Theory of Money and Credit that seem to support their view. And the problem is, those passages are pretty smoking gun, you know what I mean? Like, if you just read that one thing, it looks like, oh, Mises totally agrees with these guys. And so then it's like, well, shoot, how can he agree with both of them since they disagree with each other? It looks like Mises is contradicting himself. And so we will try to, you know, I'm not going to take an official position just, you know, because I'm teaching the class. I'm not supposed to be refereeing a dispute. But I will point that stuff out when we go through it. And the problem is partly that Mises does, it looks like it points, says stuff that's a little bit hard to reconcile. But then, like I said, this one particular thing on the definition of inflation, I was looking at it again recently, and it is a lot more reluctant than I had remembered it being. All right. Oh, and then you asked Chad also, does he see the thing with the population? Yeah, and this is part of what I'm getting at, that in some places Mises seems to be clearly enunciating the Rothbardian view that fractional reserve banking per se sets in motion the boom-bust cycle, and so you think it would be a bad thing. But then in other places, Mises clearly says, if it weren't for fractional reserve banking, then the great increase in the demand for money because of population growth and then, you know, the spread of the Western market over the whole world, which led to a huge increase in the demand to use gold, that he says if it weren't for fiduciary media, which is, you know, the way you engage in fractional reserve banking is issuing fiduciary media, meaning unbacked bank money, he says that offset what otherwise would have been a tremendous increase in the purchasing power of money. So meaning if it weren't for the availability of fiduciary media, fractional reserve banking, the increase in population and the spread of the market economy to cover most of the globe, there would have been a very great price deflation. You know, prices around the world would have had to fall greatly if we were stuck on 100% reserve banking. And so in those passages, it looks like Mises is saying it's a good thing we weren't on 100% reserve banking. Otherwise, it would have been really traumatic. So it's like that's what I'm saying. There's places in theory of money and credit where it looks like Mises is clearly saying one thing, and there's other places where it looks like he's clearly saying something else. And so it's hard to know, you know, what is his position on fractional reserve banking? Does he think it's good or bad? And it's hard to know because it's some places he seems to say it's good and some he seems to say it's bad. And maybe we're wrong for even trying, you know, maybe he would say that's a nonsense question. Maybe he'd say like that's like saying are guns good or bad? You know, and well, if you shoot a little kid in the head, they're bad, but if you shoot a bad guy, they're good. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? So maybe we're wrong for trying to infer what Mises' overall position is. Like maybe he thinks it's more nuanced. I don't know. Okay. Jan says, Austrians don't like positivism, which attempts to derive laws from experience and verify by empirical observation. But at the same time, Austrians claim that economics is not a normative science, but it is a value-free or positive science. So the word positivism seems to be both good and bad. How come? I don't know enough about the etymology of it. I mean, you're right that Austrians think that economics should be a positive science, not a normative one. And you're also right that they think they have a lot of criticism for logical positivism, and they're not positivists when it comes to economics. But I can't give you more information than that. I mean, you know, I know what those two terms mean, and they're different. I mean, they're different words, positive versus positivism. You know, one's an adjective and one's a noun, but I don't know enough about the etymology to say. I mean, if I had to guess, I would say, yeah, they're kind of similar in the sense that you're not imposing your own views on it, right? So to say positive economics is a positive science as opposed to a normative means, hey, I'm not coming here with what my preconceptions about what's good and bad. I'm just looking at what do people value, and I'm, you know, deducing laws and whatever, and I'm just, you know, I'm being very neutral here. So that's, you know, the positive there. Whereas with positivism, I think in the same spirit, they're going to say, hey, we're not coming in with any preconceptions about how the world works or what the laws of the economy are. We're just going to go and see. What do the facts tell us? What is reality telling us? We'll let the data speak for themselves. So you see how those are kind of similar, except so what the Misesian position is to say, yeah, it's correct, or I agree, to do good economics. You as the economist don't want to come with your preconceptions about value judgments. However, you do need to come with preconceptions, if you will, about what cause and effect are, or what time is, or what a direct exchange is. That you would have to know that first to then go look at the world and start doing economics. You can't look at the world and say, well, gee, I don't know what a direct exchange is. Let me go gather some observations, and maybe I'll learn what direct exchange. That doesn't make any sense. In order to even classify what you're looking at as an exchange, you would have to already know what that concept was mentally. But like I say, Jan, I don't know enough about the history of the actual terms, but they do sound similar, and if I had to guess, that's the sense in which they are similar, that you're not imposing your own views on something. You're kind of just looking with an open mind. But I think the difference is Mises would say, you don't want to impose your own value judgments in terms of what's good and bad, but as an economist, you are an a priorist, that the laws of economics you kind of can figure out without even looking. You just kind of think about it. Whereas you can't know what people value by thinking about it, or you can't. Yeah, right. So that's kind of what it is. And so that's my guess is it would be that's why those terms are similar, and why it just so happens that Mises embraces positive economics, but not positivism in economics. All right. Jan also asks, in the evenly rotating economy, there are no profits, and he says other than interest, and I would say that's a little bit confusing because interest is not profit. So I'll rephrase your question. In the ERE, there are no pure entrepreneurial profits. There is interest. So if your company gets paid ahead of time, example, gets paid for April services on the 1st of April, should it have zero profits? Okay, so I think what's going on here is the word profit can mean different things. So if by profit you mean accounting profit, if you mean it like the way the layperson means it, that a company gets more in revenue than it had to pay in, you know, money in sales figures, you know, revenue, how much money comes in the door when they sell the product compared to how much money do they spend on the inputs, then yeah, that's the accounting profit. And so in the evenly rotating economy, that completely exhausts, or the interest due on the invested capital completely exhausts the accounting profit. So if somebody, if a capitalist puts $1 million into an operation, you know, using it to pay the workers and to buy the raw materials and this and that, so there's $1 million invested in it, and it takes 1 year to create the product and then turn around and sell it to the final customer, and the interest rate is 5%, then you'll sell it for $1,050,000. That's how much the products will be sold for. And so if you do the accounting and do the books, it looks like, oh, we made $50,000. And the newspapers would report, you know, this Acme Corporation reported today profits of $50,000. But the point is they would just give that to the shareholder, who's the capitalist, and he would just say, yeah, that's the 5% I made on my $1 million investment. And I could have made that same amount if I had just invested in a bond. So it's not entrepreneurial profit. That's all. Everybody knew that that rate of return was available in that line of production. And the reason other capitalists didn't jump into it is because they were earning 5% or whatever it was they were doing. And so everybody's, and by the same token, he was fine with that. He didn't get out of that line because in the equilibrium of the ERE, he's content to earn 5% of his money. So so now Jan is asking, if the suppose now different business model. Because before, the idea was the capitalist had to take his $1 million, pay the workers up front, pay, you know, the land, pay the every, and it's kind of contrived to do the timing right, but the idea is like they made a bottle of wine on day one, on January 1st, and then they were all done, and the workers got paid and went out and got paid for their labor, and that was it. And now they just let that bottle of wine sit there for 1 year, and then it matured into a year-old bottle of wine, and then he sold it and sold all the inventory for $1,050,000, right? If you need to think about it in terms of, you know, putting all the money in up front, waiting a year, and then getting the revenue. So now Jan's saying, what if instead of doing it that way, what if you made your customers prepay? So on January 1st, the capitalist comes along with his $1 million and prepays, or, you know, pays the worker and da 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 da, and then they have these brand new bottles of wine. But technically, what they're selling to the customer is a 1 euro bottle of wine, but they tell the customer, if you prepay, it'll be cheaper. So you can wait, and 12 months from now, you can buy the bottle of wine at the spot price, or you can pay us right now, a year ahead of time, and you'll get a claim ticket. And then a year from now, you come with your claim ticket and get the, you know, the aged bottle of wine then for no more money at that point because you already paid. You could do it that way, and then your customers would only pay $1 million if everyone did it that way. So, yeah, the capitalist would get his money right back. There would be no accounting profit, but also there would be no interest because now he gets his money back right away, and so now the capitalist would have to, if he wanted to earn that 5%, he would have to go find some other place to invest it because he couldn't invest it back in this since he already paid the workers. The bottles of wine are already made. Now he's got to wait for them to age. So yes, you're right, Jan. That is true. If people prepaid, then the cut. Well, what's funny is where would the customers get the money? Because then they would have to be capitalists. So really, what might happen is the capitalist could lend the customers money at 5%. Then they could prepay, and then the whole system. You know, we cross all the T's and dotted all the I's. And it's just like a roundabout way of the capitalist would still get his 5%. Because typically, the reason it works like that is if the capitalists are the only ones who have the money that they can afford to not consume and to put up the capital. And it's, the final customers are just getting their wages or whatever and then going and spending it right away. And so that's why typically you think of it as the capitalists put the money up front and then wait for the finished product, and then people are just buying the finished product. So if the customers instead paid for the product and were willing to wait a year, technically they would be the capitalists. And so there would still be the interest return, but it would actually accrue to the customers. So that's where it would be coming in, that they would be getting bottles of wine that had a market value of $1,050,000, but they only spent $1 million on it 12 months prior. Okay. Jan says, for those people who, it looks like we've got a few more people that trickled in, if you have a question, just to reiterate, you don't need to wait for me to get all these ones that are on deck. Just go ahead and post your question, and that'll affect the pace that I go through these. Okay, Jan says, I think Rothbard said in The Mystery of Banking that monetary inflation on the free market is possible because reserves will not be 100%, but it will be close enough to 100%. Okay, well, that's interesting. I mean, that dovetails then that I think I'm correctly interpreting what he said. If you're saying that he did say that, I don't remember off the top. I mean, I've read Mystery of Banking, but it's been a while. I don't remember off the top of my head of him saying that. It sounds like something he would say, so that's good to know. Jan says, how is your Krugman debate going? Does your gym visit have something to do with it? The Krugman debate, it's the last I checked, it was like 78,000, something like that. What I'm going to do is I've just been real busy with like my actual day job stuff for a while, but now that's slowing down a little bit. I'm getting more free time, so I think I'll try to make some more promotional videos to try to get more people to pledge. And if I can get it above 100,000, then I'm going to try to get the food bank to do a press release or something. So that's where that stands. Okay, Jan has another question. What do you think of Peter Betke? I saw his debate with Brian Kaplan, and he didn't even sound like an Austrian. For example, he called attacking Robert Lucas as the Austrians' biggest tactical mistake. He criticized Rothbard for making it sound like history doesn't matter. Just curious, what do you think of him? Because I never read anything by him, but this really disappointed me. When did he debate him? I don't even know what you're talking about. In 2009? I mean, is there a video of it? I don't even, or was it in print? Huh. I'll, yeah, I'm just going to even, not that I'm going to watch it right now, but I'll try to bring it up. I wasn't even aware of this. So you're saying Brian Kaplan debate Peter Beckley? Huh. Okay, no, I mean, I'll probably watch this today. I didn't know that that happened. So, I mean, and I can't speak to what you're talking about here, Jane, just because I haven't seen it. I mean, I'm familiar with Betsy's views. For those who don't know, Peter Beckley is the head of the Austrian program at George Mason University. I mean, Becky and Salerno a lot of times butt heads, you know, online, in public. I'm not, like, revealing anything secret. They do it in public. They have different philosophies. So Becky, speaking broadly here, she's more like, hey, we need to play the mainstream's game. It's you know, we're not doing Austrian economics any favors if we all just sit in a corner and talk to each other. That we need to go out, and if, you know, maybe we don't use the word Austrian, maybe we don't label ourselves, maybe we go and try to publish with the public choice guide and do, you know, what can we learn from them? Let's go talk to these guys over here that are doing experimental economics, and let's see what we, you know. So he's more, so if you like what Becky's doing, then the way you would positively describe it is to say he gets his students to be placed at well-regarded schools, and they get a lot of publications and stuff because he shows people with Austrian interests how to take your interests and package them and sort of, you know, get them out in the mainstream, and so that you are taken seriously as a scholar. Whereas if you don't like what Becky's doing, the way you would criticize him is to say he basically tells Austrians you can't write out Austrian stuff, you know, put your research agenda on the side and go figure out what all these mainstream idiots are doing and copy them and try to blend in with them. Right. So again, I'm exaggerating both things. I'm just trying to show you, you know, that's what a fan of Becky would say would be the first thing, or a hostile critic would say would be the second thing. So that's the, you know, the dispute. I think I'll say this. When people ask me, you know, what should I do? You know, what should I tell them if you want to get a PhD in economics? Because a lot of people are thinking about getting a PhD in economics, and they ask me my advice. And I say, well, I went to NYU, and I explained what that program was. And I said, that's very rigorous mathematically. You know, you will learn the mainstream stuff. And so if you want to be able to critique it, you'll really know what you're talking about because you learned it from some of the world's experts. And I said, but you might be miserable. Like, the 5 or 6 years it takes you to get out of that program might just be awful for you. You probably have you'd be much more sane if you went to George Mason, where you'd be around a lot more people who are free market, either explicitly Austrian or Austrian fellow travelers, because there's, you know, people like Tyler Cowen and stuff, or Brian Kaplan, that don't call themselves Austrians anymore, but they know a lot more about Austrian economics than most other economists do. So I say you might have a lot more fun there, and you know, they got a lot of connections and have a lot of their former students that are all over the place. So if you really want to make this your career, just, you know, you can't just do what you personally believe in. This is what I want to work out. You got to be practical and look at, are you going to get a job? And Becky, for sure, is good at getting people jobs. So that's kind of how I explain it to people. Okay, so let's see, and Jan says, but in general, what do you think of him? Your opinion matters to you. Well, Jan, you know, this is recorded here, you know? We can't be bad-mouthing anybody. Not that I'm going to bad-mouth him, I just mean, even if I wanted to, that's how I hardly would. the only thing I've ever done in terms of explicitly criticizing Pete is sometimes it seems to me like he cares too much about what mainstream people think of us. You know, like in other words, we're not going to be at Harvard anytime soon. And now it is true, like, I think Pete Leeson had like a semester that he did something. I don't know if it was, I forget where it was, maybe it was in Chicago or something. Pete Leeson was at a pretty reputable, you know, big name school, but not as a professor or anything. Like, he was just there as a, I forget what his deal was. So, I mean, people have done better coming out of GMU than a lot of other places. But my point was, it's not like somebody who didn't care about Austrian economics and just wanted to do, you know, some hotshot kid who was great at math coming out of Princeton as from an undergrad and then wanted to go to a grad school. He's not going to go to GMU and learn Austrian economics because of the great job they're going to get him. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like if you're going to kind of screw with your career anyway because you're going to be an Austrian, you know, why don't you at least work on the stuff that you care about? And so that's my thing, in that sometimes it seems like to me that, you know, unless we're publishing in the top journals, that we should feel ashamed of ourselves or something. Is, you know, like in other words, you're a failure if you just end up at some liberal arts school in Ohio and all you ever do is teach undergrads and you never get to oversee anybody's dissertation and you just, you know, you just sit there and teach human action to kids for 30 years and then you retire, and that you should feel ashamed of yourself. Like, sometimes that's the image I get from, you know, the recommendations that Becky gives to people. I'm exaggerating. He never says that in so many words, but that's sometimes what I feel. And so, like, I've argued with him and said, look, Pete, it's not like we have the chance of being at Harvard and getting a Nobel Prize or whatever, you know, the top award. The profession's never going to think we're awesome. So why don't we just do what we think is the right stuff? And so what if you don't get published in the top 10 journals? Who cares? So anyway, that's kind of the trade-off. Let's see. Jan says, Jan, got a lot of questions. So again, those of you who are still tuned in here, it's for people listening. There's more people than just Jan, but no one else is apparently asking me questions. Jan says, you said in the different class that Bumbavrk saw that the present goods are more expensive than future goods. He rebutted the naive productivity theory because he observed that the present capital goods are more expensive than the price of the output, even when taking into account the increased output. How does he know that? By observation, shouldn't it be a priori? Okay, sorry, less expensive. So Jan clarifies, he meant less expensive. Okay, so for those who don't know what we're talking about, so Eugen von Bumbavrk, besides having a cool name, is like a second generation Austrian. So the first was Karl Menger, you know, he's the founder of Austrian economics, and then Menger's two students or successors, or whatever you want to call them, would be Bumbavrk and Friedrich von Dieser. And so Bumbavrk, and then Mises was kind of like the successor to Bumbavrk. So Bumbavrk took the marginal subjectivist insights of Menger and applied them to intertemporal goods. And so he really came up with a theory of capital and interest. So the issue is, where does interest come from? And a lot of economists say, oh, it's because the productivity of capital. And so Bumbavrk showed that, no, that doesn't really make any sense. So, like, if you're trying to understand, how come if I have, I'm just making up numbers, obviously, let's say I have $100,000 and I buy a brand new tractor with it, you know, big John Deere industrial strength, big big time tractor because I'm a farmer, and then now I use that, and so I can harvest more crops, and then you know I can sell more in the future because I bought the tractor. The point is, if I'm gonna, I can earn a return on my investment. So it's not, I don't merely earn, it's not merely that I sell $100,000 more of crops during the lifetime of the tractor, because the tractor lasts a while. I actually sell more than $100,000 extra in crops, meaning not only do I make my $100,000 back over the life of the tractor, but I make more than that. So when all is said and done, by me taking my $100,000 of financial capital and in a sense like pouring it into this physical thing called a tractor, over its lifetime, I reap more than $100,000 out of it. So that when all is said and done, I have more than $100,000. And the difference would be, you know, the interest return. So the question is, as an economist, how can we explain it? Where does that come from? And so Bombavich said, well, we have to frame the question properly, because a lot of economists were saying, well, duh, the tractor is productive. You can harvest more crops with a tractor than with your bare hands, so that's why, you know, you can earn. So that's why by taking your $100,000 and buying a tractor with it, you can turn your $100,000 into whatever, $150,000 over the 5-year life of the tractor. So Bombavich said that's a bad explanation, because the fact that the tractor is physically productive, the fact that I, as a farmer, I can you know, multiply my own productivity by using a tractor as opposed to just using my bare hand, that explains to me why the tractor has a market price. That's why I would pay somebody to build a tractor for me. It explains why I would go rent a tractor. If, you know, if somebody else owned it and I just rented it on a daily basis or something. Because I would just run the numbers and say, well, with the tractor I can harvest this much, without it I can harvest this much. I'd be willing to pay someone up to blah, blah, blah per day to rent a tractor. So, but Bombavich said, that doesn't explain the interest return. Because the interest return is saying, why is it that I can buy a $100,000 tractor and then over the course of its life cycle extract out of it, let's say, $150,000. That's what needs to be explained. And to tell me the tractor is productive doesn't explain it. And in fact, it's more of a puzzle, right? Because what we're trying to explain is, how come the tractor doesn't start out being $150,000 if I'm ultimately going to, you know, if it's going to generate $150,000 in extra revenue over a certain period. So that's the issue. So, but Jan is saying, Jan is asking, you know, how does Bombavich know that by observation? Well, what I'm saying though, Jan, is, yeah, by observation, we know that people earn interest, or we suspect, because I guess theoretically, the interest rate could be zero, and everything we see is entrepreneurial profit. But I think we kind of think common sense, shooting from the hip judgment, it looks like there is a sort of normal rate of return on investment that you could get, like with a really super safe bond or so on. And then in some lines, you know, there's above that rate of return because it's risky, and then other people earn more than that because they're really good at forecasting the future and so on. But there's like a general generic rate of return that you can if you start with $1 million in capital and you're very conservative with it, you can grow your money over time, and that's because of interest. It's not just all pure profit. So the point is, that's what we're trying to explain. And then there, yeah, you don't, to say the physical productivity of capital goods can't explain that, that argument is a priori, right? That's just an issue of framing it. So it's not that you would look out at the world and say, oh, the naive productivity theory is wrong because I observe the world. No, you would just, no, just thinking it through, that's not a good explanation. But the fact that there's an interest return that needs to be explained, that you would have to know through observation. In other words, if it didn't seem to be the case that the capitalists regularly earn a return on their money, then economists wouldn't even occur to them to try to explain something that they didn't know existed. Okay, we got time for one more here. Let me answer John Chu's questions because he's new to this, or he hasn't spoken in this one so far. So Chad and Jan, I'm going to run out of time here. So if you want to post these questions in the questions for the professor week one, I can answer them there. I don't know if you really want me to answer those. Okay, John says, the Patriot Act, does this act totally wipe out the Bill of Rights? What protections do Americans have from being arrested, tortured, and killed if the president orders it? Are we a fascist state? When will Americans be placed in FEMA concentration camps? Well, those are some provocative questions, John. I'm by no means a lawyer or a constitutional expert, so I don't know, in terms of legally speaking, what the rules are. If you aren't already reading him, John, I would highly recommend going to Glenn Greenwald's blog, because he's the best guy I know of on that kind of stuff. Where I think you'd agree with his personal morality and him thinking this stuff is scary, but also he is an actual legal expert and can speak intelligently about, is it really true that when Americans leave the U.S., they forfeit their rights? Because that's what some people in the administration are arguing. And, Glenn Greenwald will go through and say, well, no, because in this court case, the court ruled this way, so there's precedent and blah, 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 blah. So I can't talk like that because I don't know that stuff. What I'm just speaking as a regular citizen here, it is astounding to me that the official position of the Obama administration is, we have a secret group that can put your name on a list and then we can have you killed. And that's it. We don't even have to explain to some third party why we did that. Just, you have to just trust us. If we kill you, it's because you're a bad guy. And it's like, I can't believe more people aren't saying, I don't think you can do that. That sounds kind of like a lot of power that you have. And so that's, what else can you say about that? But if you do want someone else to say more about it, go to Glenn Greenwald's blog. So it's green, like the color, and then W-A-L-D, Greenwald, and his first name's Glenn with two N's. And he's really good on this stuff. Okay, maybe one more from John. Money supply in the stock market. Increases in the money supply and less demand to hold cash balances will increase nominal prices, but what drives real stock prices? Increases in capital goods in total? Okay, so by real stock prices, I guess you mean the price of a stock relative to the price of, like, a basket of consumer goods or something. Like, how many multiples of cans of tuna fish is the company that makes tuna fish, or stock, or something like that, or, the price of GM stock compared to the retail price of a new GM car, that kind of stuff. If that's what you mean. Well, it's based on their projected future earnings. So if you did think the companies were going to be profitable in the conventional accounting term sense. Also, the rate of discount. Other things equal, if the discount rate falls, meaning if people's time preferences fall, that would make the stock market have a higher value, right? So in other words, among other ways of viewing it, if you own a share of stock, that's giving you a property claim in the future dividend stream, generated by that corporation. And so whatever your estimate is of those future cash flows, your present valuation of that will be higher if interest rates are lower. Right? Just like a regular bond. If you have a bond that says the holder of this bond will get $1,000 per year for the next 20 years, and then we'll get a $10,000 principal payment. If interest rates go down, the market value of that bond goes up, because then that given stream of cash payments now has a higher spot price with a lower discount rate. So it's a similar thing with the stock. It's not contractually locked in, because you know the stock is just a residual claim, but technically when you own the stock, you know, you're thinking this gives me claim to the market value of the stock in the future, and if there are dividend payments, I get that too. And so whatever your estimate is of that stuff, if you're discounting those future events by a lower interest rate, then you place a higher value on it right now. So that's another thing too, that besides just the particular profitability of the company, that would give it a higher valuation if interest rates went down, you would think. But again, this is all other things equal. So probably if you looked at, you know, time series, you'd probably see that when the stock market starts booming, interest rates start going up and vice versa. But that's, I think, partly because if the stock market's booming, it seems like good times are here, and so the Fed might start raising interest rates, whereas if the stock market crashes, then maybe it's because we're about to enter a big recession, and so the Fed cuts interest rates. So, I mean, all this stuff is hard to, you know, you have to speak in terms of ceteris paribus. Okay, well, we're out of time today, and I will see you guys next week on Wednesday.